Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Ag Sector Council Seminar Series. My name is Zachary Bakke. I'm the Knowledge Management Specialist for the Bureau for Food Security, who is supporting this seminar series. I'd also like to thank the Knowledge-Driven Microenterprise Development Project that helps us to put on this series and makes it available online for those who are participating online via webinar. This is October Ag Sector Council. It's applying Peanut Crisp Research, or Collaborative Research Support Program, research to USAID initiatives. I'd like to point out that the next Ag Sector Council will take place November 30th. This will be done by Dan Goodall with WinRock, and he's going to be talking about USDA collaborative efforts towards transformational scalable and sustainable change in rural Bangladesh. And this is going to be going over what's called the REAP project, or the Rural Enterprise for Alleviating Poverty project in Bangladesh. So that should be fairly interesting. Also, in addition, I'd like to point out and highlight the AgriLinks blog. AgriLinks is where you'll find all these past Ag Sector Councils, as well as information about future Ag Sector Councils, as well as other AgriLinks sponsored events. We also have a library on AgriLinks that has additional resources that you can, if you join AgriLinks, you can comment, upload your own resources, as well as upload events to our events calendar. But I'd like to highlight our blog, which has become quite active. We recently had several posts from the Ag Share Fair, and this is a sort of knowledge sharing conference that took place in Rome at the end of September. It's jointly put on by IFAD and others to share knowledge around agriculture. And so we had members of the KDMD team who participated in this and were sharing their experiences. So I invite you to check it out, as well as, you know, be able to comment on it as well. With that, I'd like to invite Joyce Turk, Senior Livestock Specialist for the Bureau for Food Security, and also the USAID Manager for the Peanut Crisp, to introduce our speaker, Tim Williams, for today's talk.
Thank you, Zachary. Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for coming today. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Tim Williams, who has for 40 years striven to achieve public health and development goals through research on peanut science and the peanut value chain. Tim received his PhD in crop science from the University of Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and afterwards he joined ICRISAT in India, where he spent 9 years leading the peanut research on drought, plant nutrition, yield potential, and genotype-environment interactions. Following his service to ICRISAT, he spent 6 years at the Sahelian Center in Niger, ICRISAT as well, researching peanut cowpea and millet cropping systems. Tim joined the University of Georgia and the Peanut Collaborative Research Support Program in 1995 and became its director in 1997. He has focused on streamlining research management and on the market and use aspects of the peanut industry. His current professional interests span the entire peanut sector and opportunities to involve agriculture in the realization of good health. He has developed a strong interest in mycotoxins, particularly in the prevention and the chronic health effects of human aflatoxicosis. His research has established that aflatoxin is immunosuppressive and is exacerbating the HIV epidemic, vitamin deficiencies, and malaria in Africa. Under Tim's leadership, the Peanut Crisp has become a world leader in documenting human exposure to and the public health consequences of aflatoxin. He has authored over 130 publications in scientific journals and book chapters. He's also responsible for numerous inventions placed in the public domain, Among these is a soil moisture probe that he co-invented in 1985 and which NASA recently selected for the most recent MARBS probe to confirm the existence of water on that planet. With that, I would like to turn the mic over to Dr. Williams for his presentation this morning.
Good morning. I'm going to talk to you about the program that I've become involved in, and I'm going to focus not so much on the science, but on the applications of this to what USAID's present initiatives are. Now, the presentation is going to be divided into four sections. We're going to go through a set of introductions so that people understand what the CRISP programs are about, what peanuts are about, and what the present CRISP program involves. We're going to then go and move on and look at peanut CRISP experience and expertise in terms of production, processing, nutrition and child survival, and mycotoxins. We will then take some examples of what we are doing and how we are contributing to USAID's mission. And we are going to then go on and look at some policy recommendations that evolve out of our research and the knowledge that we develop. This is just a picture of an African market showing peanuts and the people that are involved in peanuts. Right. When we look at the Collaborative Research Support Programs, which is the acronym CRISP, we find four really important parts to this. There's 10 different CRISPs. They are all Title XII programs that are deploying U.S. university expertise for development. They're all long-term programs. I'd like to stress the importance of long-term in ag research. We have, you know, everyone's got really excited by the Green Revolution. The research for that started 20 years before. Borlaug was starting his research in the late 40s. And it took him 25 years for that to translate into what became the Green Revolution. It's a partnership. U.S. universities are partnered and partner with developing country institutions to develop capacity, to develop technologies and knowledge. And something that is inherent in and required, mandated by Title XII, is that there are mutual benefits in the USA as well as in the countries that we target. Now, this is represented here, and this sort of lists the players. We've got essentially four parts of our network. U.S. universities, we've got host country institutions, we've got USAID, and we have got development partners. And through the 10 programs, we have a network of some 500 different institutions that participate. We involve in 70 countries, and we have a whole slew of participants from that are involved in development in one way or another. Now, moving on to peanuts to introduce them. A little peanut goes a long way. You know, there's that adage that if you're feeling hungry, you just take a spoon of peanut butter and it'll fix you for hours. That is, there's good physiological reason for that. Peanuts are actually about as rich in protein as vegetable crops get, about 27% protein. The protein is of good quality. It's balanced enough. It's for adults. It needs supplementation for some amino acids for children. It's high in oil, and that's reflected in the calorie content. This is good quality oil. It approximates to olive oil in terms of its characteristics, and it's it has a high value in the marketplace. But it also has great health properties. People that eat peanuts actually have about half the heart risk for people that don't eat peanuts. It has this high satiety, and we started working on that to try and understand the opportunity for peanuts in hungry parts of the world. It also has significant nutraceutical properties. It drives public health, largely because of the low glycemic index and some of the protein structures. It, despite all the oil in it, it actually combats obesity. And that's because of the satiety effect. People don't snack so much. It also is a great food for diabetics. And that is something that can be exploited as the increasing epidemic of non-communicable diseases is reflected in the dietary changes that are occurring. It's also a good intervention for blood pressure. It has high arginine, which, as it's processed, releases nitric oxides, and that essentially does good things. It also has bioactive peptides that come from the proteins that it digests, and these are comparable with ACE inhibitors that are regular prescribed products. It has special nutritional values which get used in and allowed to be effective in as an RUTF for babies. It's significantly being used in the Horn of Africa at the moment. And it also has flavor. You can have a whole diversity of flavor too. I did not include antioxidants in there, but I should have. Now, peanuts in developing countries is, in a way, sort of where I come in. I started in a developing country. But peanuts are the second most important legume worldwide. There's only more soybeans. And if you take out the industrial farming of the Americas, there's actually more peanuts than there are soybeans worldwide. It's mostly produced on small farms. It's mostly in Africa, at least, produced by a woman. They produce it, they market it, and it forms very commonly their major source of cash. As an example of this, last week I was talking with the Minister of Agriculture from Kenya, and she asked us that we increase our effort in Kenya because she recognized the importance of peanuts. She's told me that her mother put her, the Minister of Agriculture, through school by buying peanuts, shelling them at night, preparing them and selling them on the street. That is how it is, and that is typically how peanuts are in African economies. And for that reason, a lot of the production and a lot of the economic value actually flies under the official radar. When we look at peanut production across Africa, there's a huge yield gap. We know that pretty much anywhere in Africa, we can increase yields 3 to 4-fold. It's not hard to do. 3 or 4 key interventions will do it. And then, as a final point, peanuts is consumed mostly where it is produced. It's consumed locally, and it's often part of the daily diet for Africans. Now, the Peanut Crisp right now is a consortium of 11 universities in the USA operating and collaborating within 11 countries. Our program addresses the full value chain, our production, market development, market access, the nutrition, these two nutrition and mycotoxin parts are important because that actually is necessary to drive and expand the market. And throughout the whole thing, we have a capacity development emphasis. A lot of what we do is very relevant to Feed the Future, and out of the countries, our two major centers of where we invest the majority of money are Feed the Future countries. Ghana and Uganda have 3/4 of our investment. Now, put this into USAID strategic objectives. We respond to 4 of those objectives. 3 of them are we relate to and contribute to increased food security, sustainable economic growth, and we're going to help promote global health. In terms of the metrics that USAID has articulated, you're going to help increase the purchasing power for 18 million women. We could do that just with peanuts. I'm not saying we will, but it is possible to do that just with peanuts. We can help prevent stunting and mortality through better nourishment. This is a great food. And by having increased, or even just by documenting the peanut in the economy, we would establish increased gross domestic product. And on the health side of it, part of your goal is to increase maternal and under 5 mortality. Our program, particularly in the area of the mycotoxins, can do that. And I think we can contribute if there's supporting and increased effort in this area. We can help prevent HIV infections. We'll come to that later. And rather than treat HIV, TB, we can contribute to the prevention of it. That's a big opportunity for an ag program. Now, let's look at our experience and expertise. It falls into those 4 major areas: production, economic development, nutrition, and mycotoxins. In production, I said earlier we can increase yields 2 to 3 times for African farmers. We're doing that in Ghana and in Uganda. In some cases, it's achieved through locally produced fungicides. A soap actually provides fungicide, as you can see in this picture here. That is the result of applying a solution of soap. While the picture above it shows the difference between rosette-resistant varieties and susceptible varieties. Rosette viruses can eliminate yield, but commonly without resistance you will achieve 20% of what you would achieve without the disease. We have these programs happening. We have done this kind of stuff in multiple locations. Processing marketing, our first efforts focused on cleaning up aflatoxin to allow market access. But we also developed what we call an incubator model, and this developed in the Philippines where we put people together and we do the research needed by industry to satisfy their program. And through this, we actually got, over the time that we were in the Philippines, we converted them from being a peanut exporter to a peanut importer. And we're doing that same kind of stuff in Uganda, Ghana, and Guyana. And what it's allowed us to do is to put products and increase the incomes of women through that by accessing supermarkets, accessing street vendors with stalls. Now, in the nutrition and child survival area, we started focused on use of peanuts in weaning foods. And in that area, we had, in conjunction with the bean and cowpea crisp, we had research in Ghana that was deployed in about 95. From 95 to 2002, the admissions of underweight, malnourished babies to hospitals went from having 8-bed wards in the hospital that we where we got some feedback data, to by 2002 having no one admitted ever. It was the whole management is now based on teaching people to use their peanuts, their cowpeas, and their corn to make a weaning food. We are involved in therapeutic foods. We, in the Philippines, we developed a fortified peanut butter that delivers vitamin A to many thousands of children. We have a school snack effort that is in Guyana, and we'll talk more about that later. And in the non-communicable diseases, the heart health, diabetes, and that area, our research on satiety generated as a co-product data that showed that this is a heart-healthy food. In actual fact, our data allowed FDA to award the whole nut industry a heart health claim. I think there's 17 claims for health foods. Nuts has one in part because of what we did. But the value of that to the American peanut industry is estimated to be $500 million a year. Peanut consumption was on a downward trajectory because people were worried about the oil in it. We turned that round, and now this information is used to actually market peanut as a healthy product, and production and consumption have increased significantly since the mid-90s. Now, in the mycotoxin area, we have to recognize peanuts is affected predominantly by aflatoxin, but more recently we got engaged in fumonisin, which is a maize-specific toxin. There's about 4.5 billion people that face uncontrolled exposure across the world, and I'll show you in the next slide where those people are. They come from toxins are produced by fungi, which affect corn, peanuts, rice, cassava, and many other products. But those are the major sources, because people eat so much of them. Those are the staples. The mycotoxins impact nutrition, immunity, and trade. Now, trade is actually the least important part of this. I'm quite sure of that. It's when you start seeing what this does in nutrition and immunity that you say, wow, this is something that everyone needs to take account. Now, the data that we've got, we've been able to show that there's suppressed immunity associated with high exposure to aflatoxin. This decreases vitamin A, E. Other people have shown C. In animals, zinc, iron is impacted. We have people with high aflatoxin also have a greater chance of having active malaria because of the suppressed immunity. We see, and we leveraged an NIH trial that was looking at maternal anemia, well, looking at pregnancy outcomes, and people with high aflatoxin mothers had more maternal anemia, and we had more adverse birth outcomes, underweight children. And there is also evidence that the British have generated that there are legacy effects. Children born to mothers exposed actually are stunted and have a greater chance of being stunted. And across the world, aflatoxin exposure in children is linearly related to the Z-scores. The more toxin they've got, the more likely they are to have be underweight and stunted. Now, that's where aflatoxin is uncontrolled. It's a huge area. And there's no country that USAID is concerned about that where this doesn't apply. Let's move on to application examples. In Guyana, we started working with them. We were invited to go and help them set up in a remote part of the country and get peanut production to happen. This is, the area involved is the southern third of Guyana. It's remote. You get to it at the end of an 8-hour drive through what has been used by TV for, you know, those monster rallies where the cars sort of up, sort of float down the river and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty remote. After 2 years, we knew that we had to actually develop new markets because the production was changing so quickly that we were going to satisfy the import substitution part that was available. And we looked around and we chose to change the school feeding program to base it on peanuts rather than on milk and biscuits, which were imported. Locally, they could grow peanuts and cassava. So that we went through the process of that. 2 years ago, we were feeding 2,750 children in that region. The program was expanding. It was employing women to prepare foods. We had 27 little cottage industries that were operating. And because we had a market that was there, we had people who were coming. All the money that was being spent for the school feeding initiative actually remained in the community. So there was this huge multiplier effect, probably a tenfold increase. There are now people with, you know, particularly because of this, the women are the main part of this, that certainly the visible part of it. Housing is changing, school attendance is better, and so on. But we're going to come on to that. This here is a demonstration of it. We had increased production, which was threatening a surplus. So we looked, we could accept that and let prices drop, which would undermine the opportunity for production. We went to and established that new market. We had to get some policy changes, which resulted and allowed new users. We involved in industry establishment. We created that, and we ended up with more women being employed. The nutrition of the children was improved. There was better attendance. The overall economy was enhanced, and we ended up with secondary markets because now we had little factories in the region. They could take their product and sell it on the roadside or through the local trading stores. The mission there joined us. They ended up supporting the production of the establishment of a little factory. And this here, at the opening ceremony, they dressed up some little school kids as peanuts, and that was one of them. Now, if we move to Uganda, we have our program there. It's focused on crop improvement in one part. The other part of it is focused on dealing with the aflatoxin burden. But looking at the production, our program started and enabled, in the first instance, the national program to test and evaluate Icrosat varieties. They, at the same time, started developing the capacity to make their own crosses, and now they are a full-fledged breeding program. They've released 6 varieties that cover some 60% of Uganda's peanut production, and an independent economic assessment indicated that this is worth about $47 million per year. The money that we invested in it has been over 10 years, about $1 million. So, you know, that's a good return on that investment. The technologies that we have developed, the varieties, are now being distributed to the neighboring countries. We anticipate that we can have benefits in Kenya, we can have benefits in Tanzania, and in Rwanda, where the national programs actually have never got and been seriously involved in peanuts. Now, if we move on to the global, I want to talk particularly about our toxin binding technologies. At the very beginning of our program, we found that oils being produced in villages in Senegal were contaminated with aflatoxin, and we were trying to find a way to address this. And Tim Phillips in Texas worked with it and found that the aflatoxin bound to certain minerals. So from that, we got involved in this. The binding technologies, these are safe products, and binding technologies were added to cattle feed. The USDA got excited about it, and because we now have a major impact in the animal industry as a result of this, because between 40% and 60% of all commercial feeds worldwide use binding technologies, either the one that we were discovered or comparable products. It established a whole model, a way to develop this stuff. It is actually a very simple technology. This product just gets added to the food. 0.25%, 0.5% will bind the toxin in it. And we are working now to try and translate that to human application. And we have shown that it's safe for humans. We've shown that it is effective, and that we can, for something that is comparable or cheaper than salt, we can protect people, and we can protect the immunity and their nutrition. Now, moving this to policy recommendations, I want to start with the mycotoxin thing. We need to control mycotoxins, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the options in that. Because we have a cascade of effects, we're going to improve child health. We're going to, if we control the mycotoxins, we can have such a broad impact on public health. We can change just going down the sort of 1,000-day consequence. Protecting mothers will protect the fetus while they're nursing. They have mothers, if they do consume the toxin, they pass it on to their children through the milk. The studies and that exist say that up to a third of mother's milk in Africa would not be saleable by a dairy in the USA or Europe. It is contaminated. Babies' livers do not have the ability to process that. So we have this the 1,000 days is critical for many reasons, and aflatoxin is a factor in it. Now, when we look at aflatoxin management, there's a whole array of tools. And I want to stress that none of these methods are 100% effective. You can have something that is clean, and a week later it can be contaminated because something went wrong in the storage. Or it was put in a moist, humid environment. There's varieties that we can exist. We know how to find them. We could find them better with genomics, and that's something that we are working on. But there are varieties. There's a competitive fungi opportunity where fungi that don't produce the toxin are introduced and grown in the field to swamp out the opportunity from harmful, dangerous ones. Irrigation is an important opportunity. Drought in all crops promotes aflatoxin. And then there's integrated pest management, because that works. Damaged pods are ones that the fungus can infest and grow in. Then we get ground in through harvest. We need to manage moisture. We need to get the crop from wet to dry really fast. Timing of harvest is important. Harvest methods can change and influence this. Then we come to post office. We've got storage. We have got removal options. Now, American peanuts get sorted at least 5 times before you eat them. They systematically work to keep and remove the toxins. Now, the technology that we bring into this, we have worked through many of these tools, and we have them as part of the toolbox for management. The one that is not widely recognized is the toxin binding agents. This technology is used, and it's recognized by the EU as a valid technology to address for animal feeds. You can, and what it does, and what's important about it, is that it allows you to recover contaminated food, at least for animal use. There are people in the States here that actually look around, and when farm produce or stuff that's in silos gets contaminated, they buy it at a huge discount, they add clay to it, they feed it to their cattle. And the same applies to distillers' grains. This technology can be used to recover distillers' grains which have concentrated levels of aflatoxin. Now, I want to move on and look at this correlation between corn and HIV. I discovered this correlation because I was working on down the hypothesis that because we suppressed immunity, we should see this in the incidence of infectious diseases. And you can see that in actual fact, infectious diseases across is the only one at the top level aggregation of transmissible disease. MAIS is the one. But MAIS is only and is specifically correlated with HIV. That is a correlation, and we have to consider causality, which we will come to. Well, we'll do that perhaps in discussion. But the other thing that I want to show on this is this relationship between a particular cancer, esophageal cancer, was discovered as to be also correlated with MAIS in South Africa when they were working with a very small population. And they established that another mycotoxin, fusarium, is the cause of that accelerated disease instance. Now, if you're looking at aflatoxin, you should actually see the liver cancer being promoted. If the world is exposed to aflatoxin, liver cancer will be your indicator. And you can see this in the rice, in the peanuts. Cassava, there's less because much of cassava is eaten dry or wet. Only the dry version will carry or has the risk of aflatoxin. Maize, in contrast, actually is negative, despite being a major purveyor of aflatoxin. And that happens because people don't live long enough to get it. Liver cancer is manifest after 50 years of age. And people have usually died earlier, or the lag time on the esophageal cancer is much shorter. Now, what does this mean? I think for USAID, I think we need to take a holistic view of the mycotoxins. We need to remember that it is most important for health and nutrition. The trade part, I think, is smaller. I think very clearly is smaller. If you sit down, the estimated cost of aflatoxin to trade was $800 million. What is the cost of 43% of the burden of disease being modulated by that? It's you're starting to talk millions of people, not hundreds of thousands of people. I think that for USAID, you need where they program in HIV, TB, and malaria, they need at least to have a metric of aflatoxin exposure. I think that that's really important, because when you start doing that, you start understanding, or at least be able to discount it as a factor. The same thing applies for nutrition. Now, I think we aren't there yet, but I think that the binding technologies can be a stopgap to that. I think that to go through the conventional approaches to food quality with aflatoxin in food insecure situations, we're talking about a 10 or 20 year horizon. We can, if we wanted to, deploy this clay within a few years. I mean, we already have trials that show it's safe on humans. We've got trials showing that it's effective on humans. We need to have more trials so that people understand and that there's a weight of evidence that this is just not the peanut crisp that's promoting this. But we need that to happen. We know that it's going to impact child stunting because of the linear relationship between exposure and Z-scores. From our data, we know that we're going to change birth weights. We're going to improve childhood nutrition, and I think it's really important for the 1,000 days. I think here we need to remember that peanuts are within the context of multiple things. We can change production, but we have learned, and I think this, that we have to actually involve the whole continuum. We have to take a big picture on that. Peanuts are not in isolation. They are relevant to health. They are relevant to many things. I'm on the countdown to the end. I'm nearly there. I think our projects need to have that broad approach, and I urge that as the Feed the Future tries to focus us, that we actually sort of have some space to look at the bigger picture of where we are. We need to, at the CRISP, we need to think about policy as part of the environment that we're working in, and perhaps have more programs in that area. I think, finally, emergency food, peanuts, provide peanuts with a great opportunity. Peanuts are used in RUTFs because they are so energy dense. We have a program that's looking to join peanuts with other local ingredients to make lower cost RUTFs. Right now, the limitation to the amount of children that can be saved is cost. And that's largely driven by the milk component. If we can greatly reduce that milk component, then we can actually treat more people. And then we also have the opportunity to provide protection and cross protection from other contaminated foods by adding the clay as part of the mix. Now, in the emergency thing, peanuts are particularly important because they've got a low payload factor. There's twice the energy and four times the protein in peanuts as there are in a maize-based intervention. And I think another very important thing in that first wave of response to a crisis is that peanuts have a very low energy requirement. Peanuts can be eaten raw without detracting from their food value. In actual fact, a lot of peanuts worldwide are eaten raw anyway. People choose to eat them raw. But if you choose to roast them, it takes a fraction of the energy that, to prepare them that you would spend on preparing beans or some other maize-based product. Peanut butters are curiously a great opportunity to manipulate bacteriology. Where you have unsafe waters, you could actually address some of this by putting peanuts, probiotic bacteria into peanut butter. They survive in there. You know, there was in the States, we had that issue of salmonella. And the lesson from that for me was that this is a good place to put bacteria. And those bacteria could also be vaccines. We could deliver live vaccines through peanut butter, perhaps without the value chain, I mean the cold chain. Finally, as we move towards trying to plan for the next 5 years, we set up a meeting to do a strategic planning evaluation of where we are. This is going to be done in Malta, not because it's a holiday resort, but because it's actually cheaper than doing it in Washington. You know, it's 10% cheaper to be there than to be here. And the majority of the people we think that are going to come to this meeting will actually come out of Africa. So it's a place that where we can bring them and do it. But that is where we are. And if people are interested to join in this, we would be very happy for them to join us as we consider what next to do for peanuts. Thank you.